today, a judge in New York City will hear arguments over whether the job ratings of teachers can be released to the public. So far, these scores have only been shared with the teachers themselves as well as with their principals. Now the city wants to give the information to the media. Here's Beth Fertig of member station WNYC.
Any principal can tell you it's easy to spot great teachers. They're the ones like math teacher Maria Peña Valenzuela, whose seventh graders can eagerly compare the spatial dimensions of a basket to a flat piece of paper.
Can I put something inside?
No.
Can I put in water?
No.
The 27 students in this classroom at PS 189 in Brooklyn are completely absorbed in the lesson. But Valenzuela's students aren't just engaged. Principal Berta Faustin says they're thriving academically.
In some instances, all our children show growth, a year to 2 years growth, year after year.
By contrast, Faustin says only half the students in classes taught by her least effective teachers made a year's worth of progress. New York City Deputy Chancellor John White says the city compares how well students are predicted to score on state math and reading tests to their actual results.
And when you look at the difference between the average of the prediction and the average of the result, that's how much impact the teacher had.
All teachers are ranked on a curve, meaning most will be average. White says the city is primarily interested in those who consistently score in the top and bottom. He says the city compares similar groups of students, such as those still learning English, and teachers with similar levels of experience. For 3 years, New York City has been quietly rating 12,000 elementary and middle school teachers this way. This year, in response to requests by the media, it planned to publicly reveal the names of the teachers and their ratings. That prompted a lawsuit by the teachers' union, which argued the city had agreed to keep that information private. Michael Rowat, a music teacher and union representative, says if the data's released, it shouldn't be attached to any names.
And then you have a stigma attached to you or your name wherever you go. I mean, if you leave New York City to go and work in California and Georgia, Florida, this will always follow you.
Earlier this year, the Los Angeles Times caused a controversy when it hired a consultant to rate the effectiveness of thousands of teachers based on student test scores. In New York, the teachers' union also argues that the ratings are prone to error. Daniel Koritz, a professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, says it's hard to pinpoint an individual teacher's role in student growth.
And there has been study after study that shows that rankings of teachers based on a single year's worth of kids, single year of data, are just not stable. That teachers who are ranked highly effective 1 year may be seen as either mediocre or in some cases as ineffective the following year.
But U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan has said rankings can still help teachers improve and should be shared with the public. The Obama administration has been using federal grants to encourage states to develop ways of measuring teacher effectiveness. Eric Hanischek, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution of Stanford University, says even imperfect ratings can be useful.
I think that we have deprived parents of information about their teachers and the performance of their schools for too long.
And Hanischek says the genie's already out of the bottle because parents are sure to keep pushing for more information about their children's teachers. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.
The Nobel laureate Nadine Gordimer has long used her writing to explore and to celebrate her native South Africa. Out now is a new collection of her short fiction spanning nearly six decades. It's called Lifetimes, Stories 1952 to 2007. Alan Chuse has this review.
Nearly 90 years old now, Gordimer began publishing stories in the late 1940s. Among the more than three dozen stories collected in Lifetimes, you'll find a stylistic range from longer, more leisurely realistic tales to the short, and decidedly more experimental stories. I really enjoyed the extremes, from the realistic novellas such as Something Out There, a brilliant kaleidoscopic portrait of life in the midst of apartheid, to the brief, intense portraits of people caught deep in the midst of their lives, such as in the at first plain-spoken story called The Bridegroom. This tells about a young Afrikaner road construction boss gathering his life together in preparation for marriage. Toward the end of it, this character witnesses an impromptu evening of music by his work crew, and the story touches on the sublime. The lyre player picked up his flimsy piece of wood, Gordimer writes, and slowly what the young man was feeling inside himself seemed to find a voice. Up into the night, beyond the fire, it went, uncoiling from his breast and bringing ease, as if it had been made audible out of infinity and could be returned to infinity at any point. This superb collection, almost 600 pages long, gives us a series of masterly drawn glimpses into the story-making art of one of Africa's great modern literary geniuses, and gives us an intimate glance into the hearts and souls of dozens and dozens of her fellow strife-torn and struggling fellow Africans of all shades and tribes.
The book is Lifetimes, Stories 1952 to 2007 from Nadine Gordimer. Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
The president said he accepted extended tax cuts for the wealthy in order to get a deal that helps the economy. So will it actually help? We put that question to NPR's John Itzde.
In addition to retaining the Bush tax cuts for all income levels, the package includes a 13-month extension of unemployment benefits, a one-year cut in payroll taxes, and the extension of some business tax credits. Economist Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics says the total package will help the economy grow at a healthier pace and create jobs.
Instead of a year of job growth that's insufficient to bring down unemployment, we'd still be hanging around 10% for the year. This will bring enough job growth to bring down unemployment in a meaningful way by year's end.
Zandi says the package should add about 1 percentage point to the growth rate next year. But Bob Williams of the Tax Policy Center says the package includes several items that will do little for growth.
Cutting the estate tax is not going to have any stimulative effect. Patching the alternative minimum tax one more year will not stimulate the economy. Maintaining the Bush tax cuts for high-income individuals will not stimulate the economy.
That's because high-income taxpayers are much more likely to save their tax cut than spend it, says Williams.
We know that people who have lower incomes spend more out of an additional dollar than do high-income folks.
That's one reason that Williams and Zandi agree that the biggest bang for the buck in this package will come from extending unemployment benefits. They're likely to be spent, increasing demand in the economy, and helping to create jobs. One of the highest profile provisions in the package is a 2 percentage point reduction in Social Security payroll taxes. Williams says that will not provide as much stimulus per dollar as the Making Work Pay tax cut in President Obama's original stimulus bill. That's because more of the payroll tax cut will go to high-income individuals.
Single people with earnings below $20,000 will get less under the payroll tax reduction than they got under Making Work Pay. Couples earning less than $40,000 will find themselves in the same situation. Those are the people most likely to spend money, and yet you're reducing the tax cuts for them and putting less money in their pockets.
For instance, a couple making $36,000 a year would get a payroll tax cut of $720 under the new plan. Under the Making Work Pay program, they were getting a tax credit of $800. That program expires at the end of the year and won't be extended by this new tax deal. Meanwhile, a couple making $200,000 could get $4,000 from the payroll tax cut. That would be a pleasant surprise for higher-income households who got little or nothing from the Making Work Pay program. It phased out for households with incomes over $75,000 a year. In all, the package of tax cuts and unemployment benefits could cost the budget about $700 billion over the next 2 years, according to the White House. That means the federal deficit will remain around $1.3 trillion in 2011, says Mark Zandi. But, he says, it's a reasonable course of action under the circumstances.
Because it ensures that the economy will gain traction and grow, and a necessary condition for addressing our fiscal problems, at least over the longer term, is a growing economy.
But, Zandi says, once the economy is growing again, policymakers will have to pivot quickly to address the deficit problem before it becomes a crisis. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Guy Raz. Now, until we install a webcam in the studio, and don't hold your breath, you won't see what we look like from day to day.
That's true, and that might be a good thing, Guy. We can break the suspense here. I will reveal that I'm wearing a heavy gray sweater, black pants, and red boots today. It is cold.
It is cold.
It is very cold. So we're kind of bundled up here in Washington.
We are, and I'm staying pretty warm. I've got some tweed trousers on, an Argyle sweater, and a purple tie.
And Guy, this week I've been noticing you have some very stylish sneakers.
Well, thank you very much. Trainers, actually, as they say in the UK, which is where I got these. But you know, Melissa, given that we are on the radio and no one sees us, I don't think we're doing too bad with our sartorial sensibility here.
Speak for yourself, Guy.
But I was hoping to actually get some more fashion advice. So I called up two superstars in the world of men's fashion. First up is the Southern designer Billy Reid. And earlier this year, he was named GQ's Best New Menswear Designer of the Year. And he works out of a studio in Florence, Alabama. And here's how he described his line.
We sort of mix the very tailored elements with sort of more workwear, washed down, chino, Oxfords. So it's sort of like mixing the cottons and the wools together, so to speak.
So what's the one item of clothing you're most excited about to wear this winter?
Well, I'm sort of an outerwear freak. We have what we call a 40-ounce Melton, which is this heavy wool cashmere cloth that we do in a sort of a long trench coat. Mm. You know, as a Southerner, you sort of look forward to traveling up north or in a colder climate to get to wear some of those things.
Yeah, you won't be wearing cashmere heavy cashmere wool in Florence, Alabama this winter.
You know, it's you know, parts certainly we're in northern Alabama, so we do get four seasons, and it's chilly today. I think our wind chill was at 17 this morning, so we do get some chilliness, you know, but it'll warm up to 50 today, so you need things that are somewhat versatile, lightweight. You know, at certain times, a great vest over a blazer is plenty.
So, I see, a vest coat over
like a down vest or like an outdoor vest. I mean, what we'll do in a lot of cases is take things that are classic, traditional things and mix them with outdoor elements, which is, you know, somewhat of a look that we do quite a bit.
Well, Billy Reid, thank you so much.
Guy, thank you. We appreciate it.
That's the designer Billy Reid speaking to us from Florence, Alabama. Let's head north now to Joshua Kissy. He's from the Bronx, and he's one half of the duo behind the blog StreetEtiquette.com. The blog has been making all sorts of waves in the fashion world. It's been featured in GQ and Vogue and other places, and the guys behind it have been called the new ambassadors of urban style. I asked Joshua Kissy to describe the term street etiquette.
Every time we're asked this question, it kind of trumps me. I mean, I can't just say I'm prep or, you know, even Americano or military. I mean, it's a mix of things that we're influenced by.
Yeah, I've seen you wear like tweed coats and button downs and jackets. Yep. And bow ties with a black beret.
Yeah, yeah.
But like a purple, and then like purple shoes.
Yeah.
And then rolled up pants, skinny jeans.
Rolled up pants, yep.
So Joshua, what is the one item you'll be seen in a lot this winter?
When it comes to outerwear, I'll say my vintage aviator jacket. I have it on. It's pretty nice. It has like a nice sterling fur lining and fur collar. It's pretty warm. As far as shoes, I'd be wearing Beetle boots that I have on right now. They're very comfortable. They have a nice silhouette.
Where do you get them?
eBay. I got them for like $20. They're floor shine boots.
Right. Okay. And so when you think about, you know, the winter season coming up, what's sort of the one must-have fashion item for men out there?
I would say a nice peacoat. I mean, peacoat is classic, is military, and it kind of fits with everything you would wear in your wardrobe. And it looks great on everybody. So a nice warm peacoat will keep you warm this whole winter.
Joshua, what's something that I should not be wearing outside now? Like if I wore it outside and you saw me, like we passed each other on the street in New York, you would think that guy just checked his fashion sensibility in 2008.
maybe... I mean, this is no offense to anybody, but maybe bootcut jeans, you know.
Bootcut jeans,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, bootcut jeans.
I have a pair of those.
Oh, man, sorry about that.
I'm going to go home and throw them away.
Please.
That's Joshua Kissy of the blog StreetEtiquette.com. And, Melissa, I suggest that you ask your husband, Stefan, to check out that website. It is very, very cool.
Are you trying to tell him something?
No, not at all, not at all. But, you know, it might inspire him to throw in some purples and pinks and maybe some skinny jeans into the mix.
Okay, noted.
Here we are in the middle of the holiday shopping season and the holiday shipping season. In fact, we'll soon be in the last-minute holiday shipping season, and UPS is boosting security measures. NPR's Kathy Lohr has the story.
If you go to any UPS retail store, you'll have to verify your identity before you can ship a package.
It's a measure of public safety.
Susan Rosenberg is a spokeswoman for Atlanta-based UPS.
It's one more way that we can take an extra measure to know that the people that are presenting packages to us are who they say they are.
All retail outlets, including UPS stores and mailboxes, etc. locations, now require customers who ship packages to show IDs, such as a driver's license or passport. Rosenberg says the change is not directly related to an October incident when explosives were found in a printer cartridge on board an overseas UPS cargo plane headed for Chicago. But she says it's part of the shipping giant's ongoing security review.
Since October, we certainly sharpened our focus, but this is just one more enhancement that we can make to ensure the safety at our facilities, for our customers, for their packages that they're shipping, and for the communities where we operate.
Rosenberg says it's a prudent step, as retail outlets will see a significant increase in business during the peak season. UPS predicts it will deliver 430 million packages between Thanksgiving and Christmas. That's a 7.5% increase over last year. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
From the Louisiana shore, the Gulf of Mexico may seem like a murky sacrifice to our thirst for oil and gas, but that's not the case when you get far offshore. The waters turn crystal clear, and in places, marine life thrives along the seafloor. Last month, scientists set out on an expedition to find out how those ecosystems are doing after the BP oil spill. NPR's Richard Harris joined them.
If you want to know what's going on at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, you've got to go down there and look. And that's just what biologists have been doing with the help of a little white submarine named Alvin. This three-person sub dived almost every day from the stern of the research vessel Atlantis, gradually edging toward ground zero, the BP wellhead. As the Alvin comes back on board, scientists huddle around its collection basket to see the day's haul. This one has plexiglass cylinders filled with mud from the bottom, strange red rock samples, and seawater in special pressure vessels. Andreas Teske from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill looks appreciatively at the day's treasure.
It was one of the best dives.
Teske explored a habitat you would never expect to find nearly a mile under the sea. Mussel beds, orange and white bacterial carpets that spread across the seafloor, fish and shrimp and sea cucumbers, and all around an underwater lake. Yes, a lake on the seafloor made up of super salty water, brine.
So you could see the surface of the brine pool just like the surface of a garden pond, totally clear. And then in the brine pond, some animals that fell in pickled, dead crabs and others. So once they fall in and they don't manage to climb out quickly, that's it.
Scientists dubbed this spot Dead Crab Lake on behalf of the hapless crabs that stumbled into the brine and pickled themselves in the process. Expedition leader Samantha Joy is from the University of Georgia. She first learned about this rich and otherworldly habitat about 15 years ago when she took her first deep dive in the Gulf.
I had never heard of such things. I had never really imagined that they existed. And it was just a pretty spectacular first dive. It's a little lake you could have walked around with your dog, but it was under, 1,600 feet of water.
This spot, about 20 miles from the BP oil well, seemed to be out of harm's way. But Joy says there are more than 1,000 biological hotspots like this in the Gulf of Mexico, and she's here to figure out what the oil spill might do to them. The next day, she and colleague Ian McDonald from Florida State University emerged from the Alvin talking about an even stranger place, a place where oil and gas seeps naturally from the seabed.
So, what a cool sight, Oil Mountain.
McDonald and Samantha Joy saw worms that actually live in ice made from frozen methane and water. The worms didn't seem to mind being slathered with crude oil from the natural seep.
We actually got footage of a crab chomping on what we think are ice worms, but it was just mind-boggling. I've never seen an invertebrate like living in crude oil, but these guys were in the crude oil, just happy as could be.
So here's a site that's been oily like this, and seeped in oil, saturated in oil for 20,000 years probably, where the ecology, the organisms, the microbiology is completely adapted to dealing with this oil.
But McDonald says that seep is putting out maybe a barrel a day, vastly less than what spewed from the BP well. And that raises a question.
What happens to the natural ecosystem? How does that respond? How do the organisms cope with that?
To answer that question, the scientists will need to move closer to the wellhead. Joy will get to see for herself on her next dive. And our story continues with that tomorrow. Richard Harris, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.